voter Andrew Kupka. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, John?
I'm just fine. Are you still undecided down there in Atlanta?
I am still undecided as of this morning, yes.
So I guess you've got a job to do today, right?
I am reassessing and giving it a lot of thought.
Anything that happened over the weekend sway you at all? Anything?
There was an Obama ad that I didn't particularly like.
Did you see any McCain or Obama masks out there among the trick-or-treaters on Friday night?
There were one or two, yes, and a Sarah Palin or two in the crowd as well.
More Obama masks, though, right?
Yeah, maybe one or two, yeah.
Andrew, can I call you Andy?
No, you still have to call me Andrew.
Okay, Andrew. So we're so concerned about this prolonged episode of indecision on your part that we've decided to send a team of producers and my co-host Adora Udoji down to Atlanta to make sure we're there when the light bulb goes off. Are you okay with that?
Absolutely looking forward to that.
We're going to be with you to the bitter end, Andrew, okay?
And I with you.
And we've even got a theme for you. An exit poll gone wild. Kupka's got bupkis. He's still undecided.
Undecided. Hey, hey.
You know it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, November 3rd. One more day of indecision for Andrew Kupka. We're going to be talking with him later in the hour. It's the last day of campaigning. We're looking at decisions in congressional races all over the country, the eloquence of women who blazed the trail long before Barack Obama, and what early voting is saying about tomorrow's turnout. Those stories, but first headlines. Welcome to the day before the day, all right? John McCain campaigned in Pennsylvania wearing underdog garb.
The pundits have written us off just like they've done before. My friends, the Mac is back.
And Sarah Palin was in Ohio on Sunday.
The time for choosing is near. Ohio, are you ready to help us carry your state to victory?
Barack Obama had a stump speech with a new metaphor.
We've been through an 8-year storm, but a new day is dawning. Sunshine is on the way.
And Joe Biden, Obama's running mate, talked about imagination.
Imagine a president who is strong enough to confront our enemies, wise enough to consult and enlist our allies, and sure enough to end this war in Iraq.
Postscripts from the campaign, and Femi Oke is here with the other headlines.
Thanks, John. Just days into his new job, American Commander General David Petraeus got a warning from Pakistan's defense minister. The defense minister warned Petraeus that the strikes are inflaming anti-American sentiment, and that's the strikes that are happening between the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan. And badly needed aid is on the way to the Democratic Republic of Congo. The rebels and the Congolese army say that they will keep the aid workers safe. John.
You know, I hesitate to ask you what your slogan is for the campaign. Maybe we'll find out about it tomorrow on Election Day. Hold that thought. One more day. What's your slogan for this 20 months of history? And if you're voting early, we want your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE in America's exit poll. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Hard to believe, Patrick, we made it.
We did.
We are here. It is the Monday before the day of the election 2008.
And just think, just 20 months ago, there was one name on everyone's lips. Dennis Kucinich.
Dennis Kucinich, that's right. Where are they now? Actually, that's our show tomorrow. Where are they now? Patrick Henry Bass is with us. Adora Udoji is out in Georgia, the recently anointed toss-up state in this topsy-turvy, crazy 2008 election. This is a moment of anticipation.
It truly is. It's a cliffhanger.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's a cliffhanger.
You
but
don't
it's
think
a,
so?
It's a historical cliffhanger. What will be the history that is made tomorrow? I think that's really the question.
Either way, history will be made.
Indeed. That is correct. And the history that will be made will have to do with simple voters in places like Pittsburgh and Lisbon, Ohio, making a very quiet personal decision.
I've become cynical about what the Republican Party can do. I feel like the Republican Party has left me.
No Obama in the White House, so that's my opinion.
No Obama?
No Obama.
You don't like him?
No.
We're going to take you now into the deepest of the battleground domain of America, across a hotly contested border between Pennsylvania and Ohio. It's a place that goes from black to white and black again. It goes from middle class to not so middle class and back again. And it goes from the Rust Belt to the new tech economy tentatively. It is the place that is completely in play in this election. We don't know if Eastern Pennsylvania or Western Pennsylvania and Eastern Ohio will be decisive in election, but we do know that all of those voters are in play and are hotly contested by the candidates. And Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein has journeyed through Western Pennsylvania and Eastern Ohio for us. She joins us now to take the pulse of perhaps the front line in this battleground. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, John.
So where are you exactly and why?
Well, I'm in Pittsburgh, and yesterday I drove from Pittsburgh in Allegheny County in western Pennsylvania out to Columbiana County in eastern Ohio. Now, Columbiana County is a red county. It is tiny, and yet John McCain has been there. Joe Biden has been there. This is not a place that is being ignored. And just to give you a sense of what it's like, I was driving from Pittsburgh to Columbiana County down Route 30, and the one radio station that I could get in was playing the Dixie Chicks. So they are back on the radio, on country radio. There are a lot of signs for fishing, for hunting. People are selling fish. They're selling, one sign said, Farwood, not to be condescending about it. That was Farwood. But, I mean, this is really poor
Farwood,
subsistence
Farwood.
Area.
I get it.
Exactly. So you'd expect to see a lot of McCain-Palin signs in this area. And I did, but what surprised me is not too far from that sign, I saw an Obama-Biden sign. I saw some big Obama-Biden signs out in the hay fields in this area. And I drove into Lisbon, Ohio, a small old town, a beautiful old town, you know, real Americana, where they've got the bunting in the hardware store. And I stopped at the steel trolley diner for lunch and sat down with the guy that identified himself as Bob the Roofer and his friend John. And I thought that I was going to expect what they were going to tell me. They were just finishing up their apple pie. Listen to Bob and then listen to John. What he says may surprise you a little bit.
And what do you think about Senator Obama?
I don't like the crowd he keeps. Let's see, who's for him? Hamas is for him. Ahmadinejad or whatever that idiot's name is, they're for him. They can't wait for him to win. So that tells me I don't think he's real American. His wife's not proud to be an American, so I am. I don't like him. Not because he's black. Don't have more power to him. I'm glad he got where he did. But just a little Harvard boy. I like Sarah Palin, who is she's one of us.
You guys disagree.
I voted for Bush. Bush didn't do what he was supposed to do.
You know, how can you vote for somebody like that?
And McCain's just a follower. Man. You know, that's his buddy. He's going to follow the same thing. Gas prices went out of sight. I was in the gas business for 40 years, so I know all about it.
You mean in gasoline? You had a service station, or?
Yes, I had a service station.
What happened?
Well, people come in and started selling gasoline 25 cents a gallon and not below what I paid for it. Put you out of business.
So there we are in Lisbon, Ohio, and we've got two Republicans strongly disagreeing over who they're going to vote for. It suggests that Republican support in this supposed red stronghold is pretty soft.
Yeah, I mean, even in Columbiana County at the Democratic Party headquarters, the head of the volunteer effort there was a two-time Bush supporter. And, you know, these are the people that Hillary Clinton, you know, called the so-called hardworking Americans, the white Americans that were voting for her and that she was arguing Barack Obama was never going to get. But when you listen to a little bit more of what John has to say, you see that, in fact, he seems to have got them.
Can't say that the black people are not American. The black people are American as you are, as I am. You know, we come to this country, we're foreigners. They come to this country, they're foreigners. You have to take them for what they are now. They are here. And, you know, if you're prejudiced of them, I don't think that's a very good way of doing things. If prejudice is what's going to keep him out of office, then well, this is not a free country anymore then.
Do you think it will?
No, I don't. I think he's your next president.
Boy, you can hear the journey in those words. Patrick, what do you think of that guy?
Wow. I mean, yeah, he's awesome. Really. I mean, what's the name of the county again, Andrea?
It's Columbiana County. It's a county that, you know, does have some Democrats, but went pretty heavily for Bush in 2004 and 2000. And, you know, it's the kind of place that I sort of pretty much expected to find a lot of people who said, I'm voting the Bible, and I did. And a lot of people who said, I'm voting gun rights, and mm-hmm. I did.
But it's amazing all the journeys that we're finding here. I mean, there's a lot of unexpected stuff that comes out of the voters that we've met in these counties that count, but everybody has a journey from one place ideologically to another. You also went to Allegheny County in Pennsylvania, right?
Yeah, I went to Allegheny County in Pennsylvania, which is the home of Pittsburgh. Now, you know, I've heard a lot of sort of, you know, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, they're Democratic. Well, Pittsburgh is not Philadelphia. I mean, unlike Philadelphia, has a very small African-American population. It's also the home of Teresa Heinz Kerry. So there's a reason why this area might have gone pretty strongly for Kerry. When I was here last summer, you might remember some of the voters were saying, well, I was a Hillary Clinton voter, but I really like John McCain because he's a kind of Democrat, kind of a Republican. And, you know, there's a big question. People look at the polls. They see in areas like this, there are still lots of undecided voters. And there's all kinds of arguments going on about, well, how are those undecideds going to go? And are they going to just all go vote for McCain because they're too afraid to tell people that they're not? And there may be some people that will. But there might be people like Lynn, a stay-at-home mother, who said she always votes, but she's not voting this year. So what was it that this year that sort of turned you off?
Well, there's things about each candidate that I don't like. Like, there's policies of John McCain's that I don't support, and I don't want that in the White House. But there's something about Obama that I don't like, and I can't put my finger on it.
Now, what do you think that is, this Lynn Finger woman? Is she weary of this campaign and that's what we're hearing? Or is she somebody who the Republicans should have been able to attract, you know, her to them?
I certainly think that John McCain saw in moms like Lynn a path to victory. And but there's been all
home,
of this negativity.
Fatal.
There's been so much on the radio. You know, they're running in Pennsylvania this ad with excerpts of the Reverend Wright's speeches. I mean, it has been intense. It's been the land of the robocalls. And what's happened is people like Lynn are just saying, look, I don't like them. I don't like the economy. I'm not going to bother.
But there got to be some people with smiles on their faces in this battleground zone that we sent you to.
Well, of course. And coming off the kidney walk yesterday, I spoke to
kidney
a woman
walk?
Who's the kidney walk, yes, the you know, walk for the Kidney Foundation.
Uh-huh.
I ran into a mom named Suzanne who was there with her four children. She'd actually personally donated a kidney. And she said that she was absolutely voting Obama, and it had a lot to do with her personal experience.
Personally, what I've been through in the last 4 years, losing a business, losing my home, having to declare bankruptcy, pretty much going through everything they've talked about. Personally, I don't feel sorry for somebody who makes more than $250,000 a year having to give up a little bit more.
She doesn't feel sorry for Joe the plumber. Andrea Bernstein, thanks so much for being with us in the battleground state of Pennsylvania and Ohio. Patrick, Any thoughts?
Wow, what a maverick that guy was at the cafe.
Right, that's right. Yeah. Well, that's what we're finding. In these counties that count, it's journeys, political journeys, that are going to count tomorrow on Election Day.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm here with Takeaway contributor and Essence senior editor Patrick Henry Bass.
Good to be here.
Good to have you here. How's your Dickens these days?
Pretty good.
You got a literary suggestion for getting through these tough times or even thinking about it? You know, actually, it's hard to have any detachment about what's going on because we're right in it right now.
Yeah, I was thinking it was the best of times, the worst of times, and somewhere in between.
That's Dickens for Tale of Two Cities.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Sometimes the cliche, though, hits the mark, don't you think?
Please, sir, I want some more.
What?
Please, sir, I want some more.
More?
Of course, for years, Hollywood has been making musical fun out of the miseries of 18th century England. And of course, Charles Dickens himself, the author, made a fortune from writing about his own personal misfortunes in that terrible time of Victorian and industrial revolutionary England. Joining us now is Dr. Robert Douglas Fairhurst. He's a professor of English at the University of Oxford and joins us to discuss whether Dickens is a pretty good window to take a look at the own economic troubles that we are going through. Dr. Robert Douglas Fairhurst, thanks for joining us.
Very good to be here.
It's great to have you on because when I knew you were going to be on the program, it occasioned me going over to my bookshelf and taking down all of my favorite Dickens and really going through what I found to be a treasure trove of references and scenes. And first of all, what are some of your favorite Dickens books which really perhaps bear relevance to what's going on today?
Well, I suppose one of the good things about Dickens is that he contains so much. There's a whole imaginative world there, which is like the one we live in, but also weirdly at odds with it. And that means that you can pick up almost anything that he writes, and you'll find something in it that has relevance today. So, for instance, the idea of poverty as bearing a kind of social stigma. Betty Higden, a character in Our Mutual Friend, springs to mind there. She prefers to go and die rather than go to the workhouse.
Can I give you a quote from there? Yeah, this is from Our Mutual Friend. Pa, think how terrible the fascination of money is. I see this and hate this and dread this and don't know but that money might make a much worse change in me, and yet I have money always in my thoughts and my desires, and the whole life I place before myself is money, 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 and what money can make of life.
I mean, that could be Dickens talking about himself as well.
Indeed.
I mean, this is a man who left £93,000 when he died, so comfortably a millionaire in Victorian money. And when he wrote Scrooge, in some ways, in some of his letters, he said that it was a self-parody. The difference, I suppose, is that his fascination with money is one that allowed him to do good with it. He recognized that money is good for nothing unless you recognize that it can do more than simply buy stuff in the shops. And I suppose the idea of value is one that he comes back to again and again. Again, this seems to be a sort of fascination for him. What should you value? And in fact, is it possible to value money too much? And that's, of course, one of the stories behind Our Mutual Friend.
And one of the stories behind the financial crisis right now. You value money too
Quite
much
so.
And then it becomes worthless. Talk about Little Dorrit, the story about really perhaps the most autobiographical scene of Dickens' young life, and that is when his family was actually in a debtor's prison in England.
That's right.
And he had to work to support them.
That's right. Now, his father, John Dickens, was slightly feckless when it came to money, and he was imprisoned in the Marshalsea for 14 weeks. And he was released under the what was then the Insolvent Debtors Act. But in the meantime, young Dickens, Charles Dickens, was working in a blacking warehouse, sticking labels on bottles. And he thought that it had broken his heart. He thought that it had reduced him from the status of a gentleman to just what he called a common labouring drudge. And you do get very strange echoes of that in Little Dorrit, where Little Dorrit, the heroine, is grown up, but she's very, very small. She's weirdly worldly, but she's also extremely innocent. And it's like a strange hybrid of Dickens's child self and his adult self coming into contact on the page.
Well, it's deeply psychological, because Little Dorrit was born in the Marshalsea and has a kind of a longing for the home of this place that is so associated with humiliation and pain. Mm. And this is sort of the way that, in which Dickens kind of weaves this notion of failure financially with failure morally. And the ability to separate those two becomes the way out. And I'm wondering if we're grappling with some of those things today.
I think that's absolutely right. One of the things that Dickens tried to do in some of his early novels was to restore an old-fashioned link between money and morality. So Oliver Twist, for instance, is born, like Little Dorrit, in poverty and more or less in captivity in the workhouse. But he is showered with riches and the revelation that he is indeed a true-born gentleman at the end of the novel. So there seems to be some kind of reward for virtue, as if he was a character in a fairy tale. Little Dorrit is interesting, though, because, as you say, the house is the prison, and the prison is the home. And it's one of the many times in Dickens where homes are shown to be peculiarly vulnerable places. They're precious, but they're also deeply precarious places. And the novels are full of houses which, well, they either fall down, like Mrs. Clennam's house in Little Dorrit, or like Wemmick's house in Great Expectations.
Sure.
They seem ready to collapse at any moment. And, of course, the novels are full of homeless characters, often children. Like Little Nell, the old curiosity shop, Oliver Twist, Joe in Bleak House, children who have been abandoned by society and left to roam the streets, exactly as Dickens himself thought that he was going to.
This is Patrick Henry Bass here.
Hello.
You just brought up the Bleak House, and talk about some of the complications of the money with the orphan in the Bleak House. I was thinking about that when, you know, with the $700 billion bailout, you know, will ordinary people ever see that money? I'm struck by that and the orphans there in Bleak House.
I mean, money for Dickens, I mean, throughout his career is complex, and it allows him to write these incredibly complex plots in which we get lost along with the characters. But at the same time, Bleak House is a very good example. He offers us a sort of bird's eye view. He shows us what it's like to see the world in a way that ordinary people don't see it, and to escape from it. So you're absolutely right that the plot of Bleak House and the financial machinations and the complexities and the tangle of red tape that snarls up people's lives is absolutely extraordinarily produced on the page. Yeah. The difference is, I suppose, that there is a way out in a plot, in a novel, as there might not be for real people.
Well, Professor Fairhurst, you know, put aside Dickens' skill as a writer, his ability to create a cliffhanger, because he did write serialized, you know, weekly installments, so he had to have a certain amount of skill as a writer. But just in terms of this material, why did it hit such a chord? Why is it so timeless, these novels of misery and failure?
Yeah, I mean, it smacks of what Ezra Pound said when he pointed out that good literature is news that stays news. I mean, in 1825, when Dickens was a teenager, the Bank of England almost failed.
Right.
And it had advanced too much money, too cheaply, to too many businesses who were speculating.
There we go. Another echo. Professor, can we just fly you over here and have you be on the show every week? Thanks so much. Dr. Robert Douglas Fairhurst is a fellow and tutor at Magdalen College in Oxford, talking about Dickens' news that stays news. Patrick, top that.
I can't.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Man, that's great. News that stays news from that Dickens segment. Yeah, Patrick Henry Bass is with us here.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
That's what I love about a radio show, live radio show. It's got a Ferrari of ideas. You're just driving it around the track in the morning. And my co-pilot, of course, for today anyway, Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Hello there, everybody. The time is coming up to 28 minutes to the top of the hour. The candidates are taking advantage of the last full day of campaigning. John McCain will hit 7 swing states during his final haul. He'll begin in Florida and then go through into Tennessee, Pennsylvania, Indiana, New Mexico, Nevada, and Arizona. That's just today. And Barack Obama's getting around a little bit as well. He'll stop off in Florida, North Carolina, and Virginia. Machinists for the airline corporation Boeing are back at work. The union ratified a new contract this weekend, ending an 8-week-long strike. The new contract preserves healthcare benefits and provides job security for thousands. Boeing is also beginning talks with the engineering union in the hope of avoiding a second strike. China's top official on Taiwan arrived in the country earlier today. He's the highest ranking official to visit Taiwan since the two sides split almost 60 years ago. And over the next 5 days, they hope to reach agreement on transit and economic matters. And finally, Obama the Musical opened in Kenya yesterday. The Democratic presidential candidate, whose father was Kenyan, is very popular in the East African country. Obama the Musical features George Bush, Sarah Palin, and John McCain, all played by a young Kenyan cast.
You're serious?
I'm not making
Obama
this up.
Obama the Musical?
Yes.
Musical in
Kenya. Okay. It's got contemporary Kenyan music, plus some country music songs as well, slightly adapted for the occasion. And the play runs in Nairobi until November the 5th.
That old Kenyan country crossover thing.
You'd be surprised.
Yeah. Can't wait. Well, I'm surprised you don't have music from it. Thank you, Femi.
It can be arranged. I have a few days.
Yeah, I have a few days. One more day of campaigning. Do you have a slogan for this 20-month-long saga?
Hello, this is Tim, a Democrat from New York. I'm holding my nose now, and I'm holding my nose on Tuesday and voting for John McCain.
Literally holding his nose. Call us with your own story, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. It's a moment of anticipation, right, Patrick?
Yes, it is.
It's also a moment of hypervigilance. When people head to the polls to cast their ballots, election law experts are going to be on high alert, waiting for any sign of infrastructure problems. What might be some of the issues facing voters tomorrow? Adam Skaggs, a lawyer at New York University's Brennan Center for Justice, is right here in the studio to talk about some of those problems. Adam, thanks for coming down.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
You know, let's talk first of all about vote suppression. It seems to be the phenomenon that has the highest numbers associated with it, and we'll get to issues of fraud later. When we talk about vote suppression, we're talking about lines too long, deliberate efforts to maybe keep people away from the polls. What are you watching, and how are maybe some of those vote suppression techniques that have traditionally worked in the past nullified by the kind of overwhelming turnout that we're suspecting is going to happen tomorrow?
Well, I think there's been some progress, and obviously there are some things to watch on that front. First, the progress. There have been a number of attempts over the past several weeks to outright disqualify voters, kick them off the voter rolls, or erect hurdles that will make it difficult for them to cast a ballot that's counted.
You're referring to some of the stuff that the New York Times has reported, Ian Urbino talking about the checking of lists against Social Security addresses and nullifying people's
That's
names.
Exactly right. That's right. Part of it. There have been a number of different ways of going about this. There have been attempts to reject voter registration applications or voter ballot applications based on missing check marks. And by and large, a lot of this 11th-hour litigation that's been brought to try and stop voters from getting out and getting their ballots counted has been unsuccessful. So that's been a positive development. But, of course, that's not the only way to prevent voters from voting, and some of the issues you just mentioned are things we really need to watch carefully tomorrow, particularly infrastructure issues, long lines, insufficient allocation of voting machines and ballots, so that voters that actually get out and show up at the polls may not be able to cast ballots. So that's something we're very concerned about.
Where do we look for problems particularly? Is there a location that matters most to you?
Well, I think obviously we want voters to be able to show up and vote without waiting in line for hours across the country. That's obviously the goal. Historically, some of the places where we've seen the longest lines and some of the biggest issues with allocation of resources is in urban communities. And so those are places we're going to be watching. And we're going to be watching particularly in states like Virginia and Pennsylvania, which are important swing states in which there are signs that there may be issues. Pennsylvania has had no early voting, so everybody that's going to vote,
right,
in person at least, will be doing so tomorrow. That's a concern. In Virginia, you've already seen litigation over the past couple of weeks in which the NAACP and other groups have sued and said there has been an insufficient allocation of machines and ballots to particularly urban and minority voting districts. So in both of these places, we're going to have to watch this very carefully. All of this will be exacerbated, of course, by the unprecedented turnout that we expect. Already through early voting and through all of the polling and the registration numbers, every sign points to there being more voters coming out and casting ballots in this election than we've ever seen before.
What about Ohio? Sorry, John.
Let me just throw one thing in. We got stats that 24% have already voted. That's the turnout so far. Go ahead, Patrick.
Yeah, what about Ohio, which was so critical in the 2004 election, especially the urban counties there? Have they worked out their issues there?
Well, there are a lot of things we're going to be watching in Ohio. The good news is that they have made a lot of progress. They have passed some reforms so that they have emergency paper ballots on hand in every polling place, urban as well as rural areas, so that if the lines get too long, if the machines break down and start to slow things down, they will have emergency paper ballots on hand, and that should facilitate moving things along pretty quickly. But, of course, there are a number of other issues. John, you just mentioned 24% of early voting. In some states, we've got more than half the number of voters that voted in the entire election in 2004 who have already cast ballots.
Wow.
In Colorado, we have almost 70% of those who cast ballots in 2004 who have already voted.
Get out. In California, it's already 70%?
In Colorado.
In Colorado.
In California, we've had more than 3 million early votes. In Texas, more than 3 million early votes. Almost 3 million in North Carolina, almost 4 million in Florida.
What's the chance we're going to get to the end of Election Day and have more people who have voted than we have on the list?
Well, I don't think that's a concern.
Good.
I
then
think
we'll just leave it right there.
I think what we'll definitely see, though, is more people than have ever voted in a presidential election, and certainly than voted in the last one.
How keen are the candidates and the campaigns on watching key precincts where voter suppression might be decisive? And is that something you welcome, or you just soon doesn't happen?
Well, I think first to answer the first question, it's off the charts. I mean, there is going to be an army of lawyers, dispatch, and observers, non-legal
by both sides.
Observers by both sides. And not only by both campaigns, but also by nonprofit groups, nonpartisan groups like the Brennan Center and others that are going to be sending observers out to make sure that if issues do arise, they're quickly and promptly addressed, and obviously to try and stop them in the first place. I think that's a good thing. I think oversight is welcome here. Obviously, there's a concern that this intense attention that's being paid will lead to partisan manipulation and will lead to voter challenges.
There are levers that are hard to resist, that's for sure. Unfortunately, we have to go. Can we call you on Wednesday to find out how things went?
Well, let's hope they go well, and
I'll
be happy to talk
about
it.
Adam Skaggs, lawyer for New York University's Brennan Center for Justice. Thanks so much for the work that you do. The Brennan Center is great.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us in the studio, talking about voter fraud and the potential for voter suppression tomorrow.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Now, if you live under a rock, maybe you don't know that tomorrow is Election Day. But in fact, there are places in the United States where the campaign doesn't have very much impact, and it's difficult for the light of the political sun that is emanating from both of these campaigns, Barack Obama and John McCain, to actually penetrate. And, we thought we would look into a place where maybe the presidential campaign has not really been much of an issue for a few moments. Joining us now is Jeffrey Merrill, who's warden of Maine State Prison. Warden, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Maine and Vermont, I want to point out to our listeners, are the only two states in the country that allow convicted felons to vote while in prison. So in theory, there are voters in play at the prisons in Maine and in Vermont. How does that play in your facility, Warden Merrill?
Well, the prisoners, if they want to participate in the voting process, then they have to request by themselves. They have to do it themselves, initiate it themselves, to get an absentee ballot from the residence of the last known residence where they lived prior to incarceration. And they have to do the work themselves and get the ballot inside and complete it and then return it.
Now, do you get any sense that prisoners care about this sort of thing, even if they do watch television and see political ads and have a sense of the campaign?
The reality is they have that right, but they very, very few exercise that right.
You know, it's not ironic. I mean, of course, these are people whose very lives are dependent upon the government, and yet they don't necessarily feel they have any kind of a stake in terms of their vote. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think a lot of it is just the fact that they have to do all the work to do it. I mean, they have to request it, and they have to complete it, and they have to follow through. So I think they talk about it some, but I don't think they really want to spend the time or the effort.
Now, the NAACP did an educational project in your prison during this campaign cycle. Can you describe what that was about?
Yeah, the prisoners in Maine have always had the right to vote, and they were concerned that the prisoners weren't really fully aware of how to do that, how to approach it. So they asked if they could come in and just explain the voting process and encourage them to exercise that right. And they did do that. There was a group that came in. We have an active NAACP group within the prison. And so they came in and had an opportunity to brief the prisoners on that, to reiterate the program and the process that we had established and encourage them to participate.
Any sensitivity on your part to getting your staff involved in the political campaign one way or another?
No. I mean, the staff, they don't engage in conversations in between their political views and that of the prisoner.
I see. Any sense? What is your facility?
It's a maximum security prison. I have actually two prisons that I'm the warden over, and I've got a medium and a minimum security facility and a max, and I've got about 1,200 prisoners.
Now, any just sort of gut sense of whether they're, you know, McCain or Obama?
No, not really.
Come on.
I think that they...
Getting this kind of candor out of a warden, I know this early in the morning, it's, I'm barking up the wrong tree here,
don't
you think?
Yeah.
Come on, a little bit.
But they do have a lot of chat because they have televisions that they've purchased themselves and the money they've earned, and so they monitor and they watch it. But
they'll be watching the returns tomorrow night. Jeffrey Merrill, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Jeffrey Merrill is the warden of Maine State Prison, where prisoners can vote.
But that train keeps rolling on down to San Antonio.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Fem, should we give him a shot? Should we let him solo?
Yeah.
Okay, throw it to Femi. Patrick, come on.
Oh, and now with the headlines, Femi, okay.
Nice!
Patrick, he's getting good at this. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning, all. It's the last day of campaigning and candidates are making the most of it. All four have multi-state Mondays planned. For Barack Obama, it's Florida, North Carolina, and Virginia. John McCain visits Florida, Tennessee, Pennsylvania, and Indiana. Now, we've been talking a lot about the races for the White House and Congress, but today we're also watching the judicial branch as well. The Supreme Court hears a big case today. It gets complicated, but the heart of it is the question of who is finally responsible for drug warnings, the drug makers or the government. The plaintiff is suing a drug company claiming the warning isn't strong enough. And the drug companies say once the FDA has approved a drug, its makers have some protection from lawsuits. The political strife in South Africa has led to a major split in the ruling party. The African National Congress has ruled since apartheid. Party infighting in September led to President Thabo Mbeki stepping down. Jacob Zuma now leads the party, and now enraged Mbeki allies are breaking off to form a new party to challenge Zuma, and elections are in spring of 2009. And finally, vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin has been taken in by a prank telephone call in which a Canadian comedian posed as the French President Nicolas Sarkozy. Palin spoke for 6 minutes to a man she thought was the President of France.
This is Nicolas Sarkozy speaking. How are you?
Oh, so good. It's so good to hear you. Thank you for calling us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Thank you, sir. We have such great respect for you, John McCain and I. We love you. And thank you for 2 minutes to talk to me.
I followed your campaigns closely with my special American advisor, Johnny Hallyday, you know?
Yes. Good.
There's no way that's real.
It is real.
Get out.
Apparently so. It took a long while for her to realize that it wasn't President Sarkozy. In fact, the prankster actually revealed himself as radio presenter Marc-Antoine Audet. And when the Palin campaign realized, she said it was mildly amusing.
Damn you, Canada. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
I feel sorry for Sarah Palin.
It's so close to Alaska, Canada. You know that, right?
Joining us now is the co-host of The Takeaway, Adora Udoji from Atlanta. Adora, good morning.
Good morning, Patrick, and good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
I had Patrick throw to Femi. He did all right. I mean, it wasn't anything.
He's an East German judge, Adora.
Yeah.
I give you a 10. I give you a 10, Patrick.
Thank you.
Well, Adora, what are you doing down there in Georgia? And explain what your strategy is for the election coverage that we're planning.
This is the Takeaway Southern Perch. We're down here in Georgia, and we're going to be watching everything that's happening with the election tomorrow, the voting, not only here in Georgia, but also in North Carolina and Kentucky and Mississippi, where there are some major races. And it's extraordinary because this morning, the Fulton County officials, this is one of the largest counties in the state, they're really concerned because of the record turnout. I mean, we had a number of people on the show, John, last week and the week before, who were talking about how they were waiting 2, 4, 6, 8 hours to vote in early voting. 1.99 million people voted in Georgia, just in Georgia, in early voting. And that's 60% of the total who voted in 2004.
That's amazing. That is amazing. You know, I have one assignment for you. It's a little one. I know you're going to be busy down there. Can you go find that guy, Andrew Kupka, you know, the undecided voter?
We are all over that.
I just want you to watch him like a hawk. If he decides, you got to be there, okay?
The minute he gets that twinkle in his eye, John, we're going to call you.
We got a twinkle cam. Thank you, Adora. Adora Udoji, the co-host of The Takeaway, down in the toss-up state, surprising, of Georgia.
Can't believe it.
Covering the 2008 elections, you will be on the air live tomorrow from, as she calls it, the Southern Perch. So are you planning an Election Day party tomorrow night? What do you think? Is it a slumber party? I guess 2000 was a slumber party. Maybe people didn't want it that way. Is it a tailgate party? We want to give you some tips for how to responsibly set up an election night party. And joining us now is Stefan Boublil, who's the founder of The Apartment, a kind of lifestyle and design agency. Stefan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Hello, Patrick, and hello, John.
Hello.
And Elizabeth Lane Lawley is in Rochester, New York. She's an associate professor at Rochester Institute of Technology, where they have some party concerns of their own. Elizabeth, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth, let me begin with you. You're trying to design a nonpartisan party. What are your suggestions for people who are trying to do this on a smaller scale?
Well, we're in an interesting position because, you know, we're on a college campus, and we're going to be having the party on the college campus. And as someone who has to teach and grade the students, I don't want to put them in a position where having an idea that disagrees with mine is going to make them feel that their grade might be at risk. So we've always done this in a nonpartisan way. For me, that means, you know, really making it clear when we send out invitations and make announcements about it that everyone is welcome at this regardless of their partisan leanings.
Stefan, it's a little different in your neck of the woods there, right?
Yeah, well, we're going to be doing something extremely partisan. We're actually going to be going for Obama all the way and be able to hopefully respect and honor three of his sides, this Kenyan side and have some food there from the Kirikiu tribe, which is Kenya's most popular ethnic group, and be able to cook some irio or mokimo, which is really a mixture of beans that comes in two colors. For his Hawaiian part, we'll be having some lau lau. pulao, which is an authentic Hawaiian entree. And, of course, for the Chicago part, we'll be having some cupcakes with Oprah frosting.
Now, you don't have any, like, quesadillas on ice in case you're going to have to come up with some Arizona cuisine in a hurry, right?
That's going to be more like Coca-Cola and Mars bars, which are going to be really the last taste of America before, I guess, we flee to Canada.
And what about some mousse?
Ah, the mousse. That's probably right. That's for the next part of our journey.
So I guess what are you thinking in terms of the late night here? I mean, this could be over really early, or are you prepared for it going, you know, way into the wee hours, Stefan?
We're prepared for this to be quite early. From the polls that have been coming out lately, we're looking at some nice Dom Perignon corking, I think, probably early in the evening. I'm hoping that way we can drink even more and wake up with a sense of a new America.
A responsible citizen there, Stefan Bublil.
Yeah,
Elizabeth Lawley, how do you keep a party like this from getting raucous? I mean, at a college, there are strong views, and you're up there in upstate New York, where I imagine it's not very one-sided.
No, in fact, it's not particularly one-sided in our part of the country, nor with our students, who tend to be a more conservative than usual mix of young people. But we have done this in the past, and we really haven't had a lot of trouble. I mean, it helps that we're having it on the academic side of campus. We're having it in a building that they think of as, you know, sort of not their personal space. If we were doing this in the dorms, or if there was alcohol involved, I suspect it would be a very different kind of vibe. But
so no streaking and no free beer at this point.
No free
right.
beer, indeed. Yeah. We're having it in the conference room. There will be pizza and soda, but there will be no beer.
What about Cheetos? What about Cheetos?
We encourage people to bring their junk food of choice. So this is a grassroots, grounds-up kind of party, not a carefully orchestrated and catered affair.
All right, and big-screen TVs for both, I suspect. Elizabeth Lane Lawley, thanks so much for joining us from Rochester, New York. She's an associate
thanks.
Professor at Rochester Institute of Technology. And Stefan, have a rockin' time.
Thank you very much. And if I can say, you know, how can you have a presidential election without streaking? That just seems crazy to me.
Again, a responsible citizen, Stefan Bublil, founder of the Apartment, a lifestyle and design agency here in New York City. Thanks, Stefan.
Thank you.
If you are partying tonight, we want to hear from you. Or tomorrow night, we want to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're always on at The Takeaway with just one left to go in the political campaign. We're asking how you'd sum up all the good times in just one phrase.
Who's going to win the election? How will our economy survive? Who will pay for what they've done to our economy and our country? This is Christy from South Jersey. Bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I.
Those are our listeners, Patrick.
I'm telling you, yeah. I'm going to see Obama the Musical.
Obama,
get my ticket now, right now. I'm there tomorrow.
You're on the plane. All right, that's great. Live from Kenya tomorrow. How do you sum up the last 20 months?
Man.
Think about it for a second.
Absolutely.
877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. You can also go to vote2008.thetakeaway.org to vote on the submissions that have already been made. Here's your takeaway.
Yeah, it smacks of what Ezra Pound said when he pointed out that good literature is news that stays news.
Yes, Dr. Robert Douglas Fairhurst, professor of English at the University of Oxford, talking about the timeless relevance of Charles Dickens in our economic turmoil. Slogan, you got one yet?
The young and the restless.
The young. Nice. We're always on at takeaway.org. If you missed anything this morning, it's on our website, and we'll have up-to-the-minute coverage in our podcast starting tomorrow morning. You can subscribe now on iTunes. You're going to blog anything for us?
Tomorrow night at the party in Harlem, yes.
Party in Harlem. All right,
yes,
I'm John Huckenberry. You
there.
Are?
I am Patrick Henry Bass.
And Adoree Adoji is in Atlanta getting ready for tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Voter Andrew Kupka, good morning.
Good morning. How are you, John?
I'm just fine. Are you still undecided down there in Atlanta?
I am still undecided as of this morning, yes.
So I guess you've got a job to do today, right?
I am reassessing and giving it a lot of thought.
Anything that happened over the weekend sway you at all? Anything?
There was an Obama ad that I didn't particularly like.
Did you see any McCain or Obama masks out there among the trick-or-treaters on Friday night?
There were one or two, yes, and a Sarah Palin or two in the crowd as well.
More Obama masks, though, right?
Yeah, maybe one or two, yeah.
Andrew, can I call you Andy?
No, you still have to call me Andrew.
Okay, Andrew. So we're so concerned about this prolonged episode of indecision on your part that we've decided to send a team of producers and my co-host Adora Udoji down to Atlanta to make sure we're there when the light bulb goes off. Are you okay with that?
Absolutely looking forward to that.
We're going to be with you to the bitter end, Andrew, okay?
And I with you.
And we've even got a theme for you. An exit poll gone wild. Kupka's got bupkis. He's still undecided.
Undecided. Hey, hey, hey.
You know it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, November 3rd. One more day of indecision for Andrew Kupka. We're going to be talking with him later in the hour. It's the last day of campaigning. We're looking at decisions in congressional races all over the country, the eloquence of women who blazed the trail long before Barack Obama, and what early voting is saying about tomorrow's turnout. Those stories, but first headlines. Welcome to the day before the day, all right? John McCain campaigned in Pennsylvania wearing underdog garb.
The pundits have written us off just like they've done before. My friends, the Mac is back.
And Sarah Palin was in Ohio on Sunday.
The time for choosing is near. Ohio, are you ready to help us carry your state to victory?
Barack Obama had a stump speech with a new metaphor.
We've been through an 8-year storm, but a new day is dawning. Sunshine is on the way.
And Joe Biden, Obama's running mate, talked about imagination.
Imagine a president who is strong enough to confront our enemies, wise enough to consult and enlist our allies, and sure enough to end this war in Iraq.
Postscripts from the campaign, and Femi Okeh is here with the other headlines.
Thanks, John. Just days into his new job, American Commander General David Petraeus got a warning from Pakistan's defense minister. The defense minister warned Petraeus that the strikes are inflaming anti-American sentiment, and that's the strikes that are happening between the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan. And badly needed aid is on the way to the Democratic Republic of Congo. The rebels and the Congolese army say that they will keep the aid workers safe. John.
You know, I hesitate to ask you what your slogan is for the campaign. Maybe we'll find out about it tomorrow on Election Day. Hold that thought. One more day. What's your slogan for this 20 months of history? And if you're voting early, we want your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE in America's exit poll. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. However you look at it, whatever your ideology is, whatever your partisan allegiance is, history will be made tomorrow, and we have one day today to think about it and to watch the last moments of the campaign. With me is Daniel Patrick Henry Bass. Why do I want to call you Daniel Henry?
I'm Daniel Bone Bass.
Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor at Essence and our Takeaway contributor. He's here in the studio with me. Adora Udoji is down in Georgia, which surprisingly is a toss-up
state. Up in the air.
You know, I was reading the New York Times this morning, and their discussion of the congressional races that are at stake around the country make it hard not to draw the conclusion that the wheels have really come off the GOP, at least in terms of what they're going to be able to do in Congress. Forget the White House. David Herzenhorn joins us. He's a New York Times reporter. He's from the Washington Bureau. David, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, John.
It is hard to see a positive in this campaign for the GOP in Congress. Is it really as bad as some of the numbers might suggest?
Well, the numbers are certainly bad, and the interesting thing, of course, is that everybody's been distracted by the presidential race, and they don't realize that this has been going on, building slowly, you know, not just even in the last couple weeks, but over months and even more than a year, as the number of Republicans retiring from the House, you know, just continued to grow and grow. And so, you know, the most interesting numbers, I think, in our story today are just about the money. The campaign committees, the Senate campaign committee, the Democrats have spent basically twice as much as the Republicans, and on the House side, it's more than three times as much to help candidates around the country.
And that almost never happens, that disparity being, first of all, in that direction and being that much, right?
Well, not in recent history, that's right.
What do you think it's going to mean in terms of the numbers? I mean, begin with the retirees and then move to contests which maybe we never imagined would be, you know, toss-ups.
Well, let's look on the Senate side, for instance. I mean, the Republicans are basically ceding races in Virginia, in Colorado, and New Mexico, where you have Republican senators retiring. And, of course, you have Ted Stevens with his legal troubles in Alaska, a state that hasn't had a Democratic senator in decades. You know, the Liddy Dole in North Carolina is in serious trouble. And, of course, all eyes are on Georgia for good reasons, in large part because of the distinct possibility of a runoff, which could keep the final number in terms of Senate races and how many seats the Democrats have unknown until December 2nd or 3rd.
You know, we were talking with some people at our member stations down in some of these areas where the races are that you're talking about here. And it's come up in the last few days, the issue of the Democrats taking a 60-seat control of the Senate as working its way into the actual campaign itself, that Republicans are saying, hey, whatever you think of me, don't, you know, vote to give the Democrats this much control in Congress. Is that having an impact?
It's hard to know. It certainly is something that they've seized on as, you know, to try and turn it around. I mean, there's some interesting things about the number 60. First of all, it's not as magical as a lot of people would think, that getting, you know, 60 senators together on any one issue is tough for any party, even if they've got the 60th or 61st seat. The other thing is that Democrats have really raised, I mean, this may be the cloud in all this for them, is they've really raised those expectations so high. And it's hard. I mean, to get to 60, they've got to run the board, basically, in all the states where they're ahead and where what are rated now by analysts as toss-ups, and then pick up either Georgia, Mississippi, or Kentucky, where their candidates are still behind. So it's not an easy road to 60 to begin with. And even once you've got it, it doesn't mean that you just get to do whatever you want in the Senate. Former Vice President Walter Mondale laughed about these sorts of ads that you're describing, saying, oh, if they get 60, they're going to get whatever they want. Because, of course, he and President Carter had that majority when they were in the White House. And he said, trust me, from my experience, you don't have to worry about it.
That's interesting. You know, there's an eerie echo of 2000 in all of this. Bill Clinton was seen as having questionable coattails back in 2000, although he did campaign. George Bush appears to have no coattails at all. And Dick Cheney's foray into the campaign over the weekend was something that Barack Obama made hay of in his stump speech. Give me an assessment of the coattails situation right now.
Well, I mean, the really amazing thing is to see how the Democrats have so many surrogates, right? Bill Clinton was out campaigning. You have actors and celebrities. I mean, Hillary is out campaigning. You know, there are so many people the Democrats can turn to right now. President Bush is basically sidelined. The vice president is sidelined. You look around and you try to find, you know, who out there can help out these Republican candidates. And it certainly doesn't seem to be John McCain. I spent a lot of time in New Hampshire, you know, where he won two primaries. And if anything, John Sununu, the senator, who's in his own tough reelection fight, is helping to carry McCain along.
Wow. David, so breakfast in your house, what is it, mini wheats or oatmeal?
That's right.
Which one?
Cheerios.
Cheerios.
Cheerios. Thank you. David Herzenhorn, New York Times reporter, speaking to us from his home in Washington, D.C. Great story on the difficulties for the GOP in the congressional races, both in the House and the Senate. That's in the New York Times today. We're going to end this segment talking about the McCain campaign. And joining us is Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein. Andrea, you've been in Western Ohio or Eastern Ohio and Western Pennsylvania assessing voters who are very much in play. Let me play for you this sort of over the weekend stump speech of John McKay, which really sort of sums up where he's at emotionally at this point.
America faces a big choice, and there's just one day left. The pundits have written us off just like they've done before, and my opponent is measuring the drapes in the White House. They may not know it, but the Mac is back.
Andrea Bernstein, is the Mac back?
Well, I haven't seen so much of the Mac. I miss the Mac. The Mac was a lot of fun to talk to. This Mac stays in the front of his campaign plane and seals himself off, and the voters know it. Lots of Republicans said to me, I would have voted for Mac, but Mac hasn't been around this time around.
So the McCain campaign has seven stops today, and they're in places that you wouldn't expect. I particularly love Roswell, New Mexico, where John McCain is going. But anyway, what do you think the strategy is at this point, in any sense of the mood and the sort of resources that the campaign is putting into these final moments?
I think the problem for John McCain is that he made his bed and today he's having to lie in it. I mean, you know, he's in Pittsburgh today. Hillary Clinton is in Pittsburgh. They made Pennsylvania a big area of focus for their campaign. Basically, they said, okay, we're going to offset Obama's gains in Virginia, Iowa, and some of these other states with the electoral-rich state of Pennsylvania. And, you know, there were some reasons for it. I mean, you know, I had a conversation, interesting conversation with Governor Ed Rendell before one of the debates. You know, we've seen a lot of sort of open and covert racism in our counties that count tour. People can go on the takeaway.org and listen to that if they want. And I asked Governor Rendell, and the first thing he said was, I told him that during the primary. And then he said, look, if someone is drowning in the river and someone sticks out an arm to save you, you're not checking to see the color of that arm. And that seems to be what has obtained here in Pennsylvania in a race that remains significantly ahead for Obama, even as it's tightening in these last few days.
What about the national strategy? Why is John McCain apparently needed in states that we presumably wouldn't have thought would be contested?
Well, you know, when Sarah Palin got up and gave her speech at the convention, where she started talking about small-town America, fundamental miscalculation from the McCain campaign is there aren't enough voters in small towns to win. And what they need to do is appeal to a sense of America that it has of itself, sort of a upstanding rural nation. This is something that goes back to Jefferson. That's where the good morals lie. But, you know, some of these towns that he was in yesterday, I drove through Hanoverton, Ohio, took about a minute to get through. And even then I saw a sign that said, you can take my sign, but not my vote, Obama. He's not getting 100% of the voters. And then he comes to a place like Pittsburgh, which is a big city. It has African-Americans. It has Latinos. It's mostly white, but it still has a lot of unions, a lot of working class people. And they've created this us versus them thing, which hasn't worked. And they've lost the suburbs. They've lost the independents. They've lost the Republican Party elites, the people that listen to Colin Powell and Lawrence Eagleburger. And it's all in all a very bad picture going into Election Day for the McCain campaign.
Well, Andrea Bernstein, thanks so much for assessing that picture for us. She's Takeaway political director, joining us from Pittsburgh, PA, where she's in the battleground zone there between Ohio and Pennsylvania. Big media buy by the McCain campaign, Patrick Henry Bass.
Yeah, exactly.
Reverend Wright is sort of making his ugly head.
And Dick Morris is actually behind that, $2 million. Right. Saw several of them last night.
Well, more minutes on the campaign from Patrick Henry Bass later on in the hour. This is the Takeaway. We want your political slogan for the last 20 months. There's really just one more day. Well, maybe a couple more days. 877-8-MY-TAKE, my take at thetakeaway.org. It's not over till it's over, right, Patrick?
That's exactly right.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We got one more day, just one more day until the presidential election, until the voting actually takes place, the election day voting, that is. Give us your slogan.
Good morning. This is Chris from Brooklyn. I've been thinking about the slogan, and the only thing I can come up with is T-G-I-O. Thank goodness it's over.
One day more.
That's right. Call us with your own slogan at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. With me is Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor of Essence Magazine. And how many times did you see Liz?
Thousands.
Thousands of times.
Thousands.
Anyway, I wish you were all in the studio with us here because we're having a great discussion of the politics and the anticipation of this day. And it's the case that we've talked almost cheaply about the historical value of this election. It's historic in 50,000 different ways.
Cynically, I would say.
Cynically, maybe superficially, but actually the path to this moment has been blazed by some really important African-American women.
Indeed. Indeed. Especially one, Charlotta Bass, who's been all but forgotten by history.
No relation to you,
No
right?
relation to me, much to my chagrin. I was hoping to hit her up for some money. I discovered she's no longer living. And I was also trying to figure out this whole journalism thing. Like when I came across her name when I'm working on a book about the black press, and I saw, you know, Charlotta Bass and the California Eagle. I was very interested in that because it's a black paper, but the paper that gets the most acclaim is the Los Angeles Sentinel.
Uh-huh.
And then I discovered that this woman had run, for national office as the vice presidential nominee in 1952 on the Progressive Party ticket. Now, my grandparents were huge Henry Wallace fans, you know, so they talked about Henry Wallace a lot, you know, who was the 1948 Progressive ticket nominee, defeated by Truman, but they never talked about Charlotta Bass, and that's like our last name.
And before you get into the character, you know, describing who she is, the Progressives weren't some fringy out of their party. I mean, they were a significant part of the election.
They were very substantial. They got over a million votes, you know, in 1948. Now, Wallace did walk away from the party. People tried to label them communists. You know, this was during the height of the McCarthy era, you know, witch hunts and scares. But they weren't. I mean, they had a great number of issues that people cared about. And Charlotta Bass was a huge Republican before she joined the Progressive Party.
Well, this is a quote from Charlotta Bass from an actor in a documentary from 1988 called The Black Press. And here is some of the words of Charlotta Bass talking about allegations during the campaign that are very eerily reminiscent of what we're going through today.
No, my friends, not communism, but common greed on the part of the rich and powerful and their newspaper, radio, and speaking puppets is what keeps us, the people, divided and weak.
Dare I say mainstream media?
Exactly. And John was fascinated about Charlotta Bass. Is at that time, she was 70. And she was a true maverick. You know, so she had parallels with someone else. A Time magazine then run by Henry Luce called her dumpy and domineering. And she paid a heavy price for her association with the Progressive Party ticket. I mean, she had been labeled a communist. You know, they tried to get her to testify during the un-American activities. You know, she eventually
she was blacklisted.
Went bankrupt, was in ill health, died, you know, in 1969. And her memory just sort of vanished along with it.
What were her political origins?
She started out as a Republican in Los Angeles, and she really was an activist. You know, she was involved in just about, every type of cause, including, you know, migrant workers' rights. Also, she led the charge to ban Birth of a Nation from films. You know, she was, you know, very much against, you know, stereotypical roles in films. She fought for actresses like Hattie McDaniel and Louise Beavers to have better roles. I mean, she had her hand in a whole bunch of different pots and was consistent, very much an organizer. She broke ranks from the Republican Party after her nephew was killed in World War II, moved over to the Progressive Party, where W.E.B. Du Bois seconded her nomination. She was nominated by Paul Robeson.
Hmm. And this was a moment when the Republicans were associated with emancipation.
Absolutely.
But we're having trouble maintaining those credentials. But the Democratic Party was by no means a place for African Americans.
She felt very uncomfortable with the Dixiecrats, as many African Americans did. And she was very much like, in keeping with African American women and their huge role in the political process, like Daisy Bates, who was the real brains behind the Little Rock Nine, a group who desegregated Central High. She was a publisher, so she wrote editorials, stinging editorials that her viewers came to every week. And I'm convinced that she paved the way not only for people like Fannie Lou Hamer, who was so critical to the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, the 1963 Atlantic showing that they did in Atlantic City, but also Shirley Chisholm, who I think we've not talked about enough during this.
Well, if 1952 campaign is Charlotta Bass, 1972 brings you Shirley Chisholm and this brand of African-American political progressive rhetoric and eloquence.
I think that if Americans, whether they're white, black, pink, green, if just plain Americans would commit themselves on the basis of their deeds and their actions to really moving in terms of eliminating these obstacles that prevent us from communicating with each other and moving as a nation of people, we won't have to talk about these things, but we're going to have to continue to create legislation or what have you that at least will protect those who need the most protection, as hopefully someday in the future we won't have to talk about these things.
Right. Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm took on her entire party to run for president in 1972.
Absolutely. And she's not an asterisk. I mean, I really do think that she has a foothold in history. And I think that she's going to be remembered far more kindly, years from now than she is at this moment. But ironically enough, the second African-American Illinois senator was Carol Moseley Braun, who also ran for president of the United States.
Right.
She had a couple of slip ups along the way, but mounted, the type of she often cited Shirley Chisholm when she was running for office. I mean, she didn't have the complexity of character, I think, that Shirley Chisholm had, or the fortitude that Charlotta Bass had, but they certainly paved the way. And I think Fannie Lou Hamer is critical in that triumvirate of Bass, Fannie Lou Hamer, and Shirley Chisholm.
When I think about Barack Obama's eloquence and success as a candidate, it is this complexity and eloquence that I associate with Shirley Chisholm that comes through.
Oh, absolutely. He's almost like the surrogate son of Shirley Chisholm, and also an outsider within his own party.
Right.
I mean, like 20 months ago when Barack Obama said he was running for president of the United States, across barbershops and beauty parlors in Black America, people were saying, "You're running for what?" And here we come to this moment. Yeah, I think something's going to happen tomorrow, right? Isn't something happening on tomorrow?
That would be election day.
I think
so. Election day.
It'd be interesting to see what's going to happen.
Well, they're not saying running for what anymore.
No, not at all.
If Shirley Chisholm was here, I wonder what she'd say.
And right. And actually, I think somewhere there are two people smiling, Charlotta Bass and Lyndon Baines Johnson.
All right. Patrick Henry Bass, takeaway contributor and senior editor at Essence, is with me in the studio. We'll have more on the takeaway right after this.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with Femi Oke with the headlines.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 27 minutes to the top of the hour. On the day before the election, John McCain's hitting seven swing states today. He begins in Florida and goes through Tennessee, Pennsylvania, Indiana, New Mexico, Nevada, and Arizona. Barack Obama's getting around a bit too. He'll stop off in Florida, North Carolina, and Virginia. Another aid worker has been kidnapped in Afghanistan. The French national was abducted in western Kabul by gunmen earlier today. They also shot and killed another man who's believed to work for Afghan intelligence. There are some signs that relations between China and Taiwan are warming up. A top Chinese official is in Taiwan for week-long talks on transit and economic matters. He's the highest-ranking official to visit Taiwan since the two countries split almost 60 years ago. Eastern Congo is receiving its first humanitarian aid since fighting began there 3 months ago. The UN convoy will bring food to the 250,000 refugees displaced from their homes. Violence there stems from hatred left over from the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. North Korean media has released photographs of its leader Kim Jong-il. Now, the pictures show him looking smilingly as he watches a soccer game. But the newspaper does not report where the actual game took place. And the country's been working to counter rumours that the leader has suffered a stroke in recent months. And last month, some pictures were released of Kim Jong-il, where he was sort of shown to be out and about. But the foliage was spring and summertime foliage. It wasn't autumnal foliage. So people said, well, I don't think those photographs are real.
They need to get a copy of Photoshop. That would help them out. That could really help them out.
They may have one right now.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
All right, do you have a slogan for this campaign? And is it possibly as good as the slogan from Jack in Plum Island, Massachusetts?
My slogan for this campaign is, yes, we can, versus no, you don't.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's right. One more day. You can vote on the slogans we've got. So far, the top vote-getters are It's the Stupid Economy and Dr. Strangelove versus Dr. Feelgood. Go to thetakeaway.org and weigh in there, too. So with one day to go before Election Day, you might be a little tired of all the political polls out there. So we're not going to talk about polling numbers, but we've brought in David Leonhardt, economics columnist and blogger for The New York Times, to talk about what's on the New York Times economics blog. It's asking readers to look into their crystal balls and come up with a few predictions about Tuesday's elections results and put them in a sort of prediction market. David, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be back.
Describe what prediction markets are, how they work, and why they're correct.
Well, one of the best things about prediction markets is actually how old they are. We think of them as having been invented with the internet, but in fact they've been around for centuries. People have been betting on the presidential election for years and years. People bet on the selection of a new pope in the 16th century. And essentially what happens is it's like the stock market. People buy and sell contracts that are tied to an event. In this case, the event would be something like John McCain wins the election. And if John McCain in fact wins the election, the contract will pay $10, and if he doesn't, it'll pay nothing.
And like credit default swaps, they're unregulated, but unlike credit default swaps, they're absolutely public.
They are public, and so they exist on the internet. So you can go to these sites, and one of the best known one is probably InTrade, and you can look at the prices of these contracts, and they tell you pretty directly what the traders think the odds are of what's going to happen. So right now, the Obama contract suggests that people think there's about an 88-89% chance he's going to win the election, and the McCain contract suggests people think there's about an 11-12% chance he's going to win the election.
Now, aside from just an idle game, why should we pay attention to this?
Well, so the question is, do we pay attention to any of this horse race stuff? And I'm an economics writer, so I spend much more of my time looking at policies and issues and stuff like that. But the horse race stuff is interesting and fun as well, as long as you keep it in its proper perspective. And one of the nice things about these prediction markets is they try to synthesize all that poll information that's out there. And they really, over the last few years, have an incredibly good record. And I want to be clear, their record is not perfect, and they're only odds. So just because there's a greater than 50% chance likelihood of something doesn't mean it's going to happen all the time. But in 2004, these prediction markets had greater than 50% odds on every state that Bush actually won and the flip for Kerry. So if you looked at a state in 2004 and said, oh, there's a 60% chance George Bush is going to win it, he won that state. The same thing happened in 2006 with the Senate race. And it was really interesting on election night in 2006. If you had been following the odds on InTrade, because they change over the course of the night, just like market prices change in the stock market, you actually would have been ahead of the TV networks. The TV networks were about an hour behind InTrade's odds in figuring out the Democrats, in fact, were going to take impact the Senate. So what we did is we took some of these odds and we invited our readers. There's no money involved whatsoever, but we invited our readers to come onto our site and make some guesses based on their odds. And we said we'll give the winner a little bit of glory, and that's what we're giving out. It's also an attempt to test actually how good these odds are. I'm curious to see whether our readers are actually really good at sussing out the odds that are not realistic.
Well, specifically, you've got a list of questions on the economics website that announces this game, and you have to answer three questions and a tiebreaker in order to play. What kinds of questions are people going to be asked to answer?
So there are a couple of obvious ones, like who's going to win.
Right.
And so if you pick John McCain and he does win, you get almost 7 points. Whereas if you pick Barack Obama and he wins, you only get 1.2 points because, again, the odds are different.
Got it.
But there are also some curveball ones, like will Bob Barr, the independent candidate, get more or less than 1% of the vote? Will voter turnout be less than or greater than 65%? We do about 7 swing states in the presidential election, and we do about 7 Senate races, the ones that people are really focused on, like Kentucky, where Mitch McConnell, the Republican incumbent, is still very much a favorite, so you'd get fewer points if you pick him and he wins than if you pick Lunsford, his Democratic challenger, and Mississippi with the special election. And in some ways, one of the most interesting Senate races, I don't know if you all have talked about this angry debate yesterday, but the Minnesota Senate race between Norm Coleman, the Republican incumbent, and Al Franken, the Democratic challenger.
Yeah, not a lot of laughs there.
No.
Now, is it possible for you to track bizarre scenarios? In other words, does voting occasionally come in and spike on strange things like, you know, Osama bin Laden is president or you know, who knows?
Yes. And it's really hard to know how much to make of this. Was this just a complete fluke or not? But this site doesn't just do political contracts, and there are other sites like it. It also does some other things. It does the Oscars, and it had a contract for a while. This is obviously before he was captured. Will Saddam Hussein be captured or killed? And in the days before Saddam Hussein was captured, the price of the contract really changed, and it spiked from about 9% to about 30%. I think he had to be captured by the end of that calendar year.
Now, could that have been because soldiers were playing it from Iraq?
I mean, anything's possible. So that's the idea here. The idea here is that if you have enough money moving around in these markets, someone who actually has knowledge, whether it's soldiers or whether it's someone in back here in the Pentagon or who knows what, is actually going to be trading this stuff.
All right. So basically, David, we want you to violate all of your journalistic ethics, okay, and find out if any of the McCain staffers are playing the game for the Obama side, okay? And then disclose them to us exclusively? Could you do that for us?
Well, that's really interesting because the McCain price on Intrade
5 seconds
was much higher than anywhere else.
Wow.
And people think McCain supporters were bidding it up.
The game is on the New York Times website. David Leonhardt joins us. He's economic columnist for the New York Times. Bid on the election.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and I'm with Patrick Henry Bass, Takeaway contributor and senior editor of Essence. We got one more day till the presidential election.
Is that tomorrow?
That's tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
And once it's over, how are you going to remember the good and the bad times?
My name is Frederick. Here's how I sum up this campaign. The worn-out maverick versus the new kid in town.
Or what Philomena offers.
A breakthrough campaign.
For these people, their minds are made up. But not so for Andrew Kupka.
Undecided and it feels so lonely.
Well, let's see how lonely it does feel. Andrew joins us from Atlanta. You know, we gave you your own theme, Andrew.
I like that. Wrote a song and everything for me. That's great.
Isn't that nice? We don't want to make fun of this idea of being undecided, but it is just a day before the election.
Right.
And I'm wondering what you're looking for to make the light bulb go off.
What I'm looking for is to just get a final sense of who I think is best ready to lead the country over the next 4 years, especially in these uncertain times that we're living in economically.
Now, I've talked to you many times over the past several weeks, and my impression of you is that if John McCain hadn't gotten you a long time ago, it's a sign of a real failing in his campaign. Am I wrong to have that impression?
No, that would be quite accurate. You know, going back to the Republican primaries, I was a Rudy Giuliani guy till he dropped out, and then I was kind of left with a whole lot of nothing. And McCain never was able to bridge that in my mind.
So what would be the heartbreak of, and I'm not campaigning here.
Right.
What would be the heartbreak of voting for, say, Barack Obama?
I wouldn't put, if I voted for Barack Obama, it wouldn't be a heartbreak. There are a lot of good things about that man. It's his policies that worry me.
Now, you have said repeatedly that you have never been this undecided before.
Right.
Who do you think you represent in America?
I think I represent a lot of Americans that, you know, come from a conservative economic base, for one, and also consistent conservative values. Now, I'm not religious right or anything, but just consistent conservative values. And that's where John McCain, I think, loses a whole bunch of base support.
Well, Andrew, as you know, we're fighting off the Leno Show and Letterman and Saturday Night Live. We're trying to get you to decide on their air, correct?
They haven't left me alone all weekend.
They haven't let they. All right, so we've sent a team down to make sure that you do it on our air, okay? You're going to stick with that promise, right?
Absolutely, if they buy me breakfast.
All right, no problem. Oh. We can definitely do that. Any chance I can call you Andy?
No.
No, I can't call you Andy. All right, well, good luck there. You've got a lot of work to do. We're going to be checking with you later today from our team down in Atlanta. And we're also going to have you on the program tomorrow, okay? What time do you think you're going to vote?
It will be in the morning.
In the morning?
It will be in the morning. Yeah, with daylight savings and everything, getting up in the morning is not an issue now.
So you're going to have to decide on tomorrow's program, right?
I'm going to let you guys know first as I make the decision.
All right, Andrew Kupka, undecided voter from Atlanta, Georgia. Just one more day.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And now, before the headlines, your slogan?
Oh, I wish I was a citizen.
Oh, nice.
I really want to vote, desperately.
Headlines from Femi Oke.
Okay, 12 minutes to the top of the hour. On the campaign trail, the end is near, and the candidates are both feeling confident. John McCain in Pennsylvania.
My friends, I've been in a lot of campaigns. I know when momentum is there. This enthusiasm, this kind of welcome, we're going to win Pennsylvania, and we're going to win this election. I sense it, and I feel it, and I know it.
And Barack Obama in Ohio.
After 21 months of a campaign that has taken us from the rocky coast of Maine to the sunshine of California, we are 2 days away from changing America, and it's going to start right here in the great state of Ohio.
Well, all four nominees are barnstorming across the country on the last day of the campaign. Barack Obama and John McCain will make 7 state visits between them, and it's a busy day for their running mates as well. And he's just a few days into his job as the head of CENTCOM, and that's General David Petraeus, and he's got a warning from Pakistan's defense minister. He told Petraeus that recent US missile strikes on suspected militant outposts are inflaming anti-American sentiment in the region. Zimbabwe has misused millions in anti-AIDS money, and that's the accusation from a leading group fighting AIDS and other diseases. The Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis and Malaria wants Zimbabwe to return more than $7 million, but has not said how the funds were misspent. The political strife in South Africa has led to a major split in the ruling party. The African National Congress has ruled since apartheid, and in September, party infighting led to President Thabo Mbeki stepping down. Jacob Zuma now leads the party, and the enraged Mbeki allies are breaking off to form a new party to challenge Zuma. Elections will be in spring of next year. And that's a look at some of the main stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So, Patrick Henry Bass, have you voted yet?
No, tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning.
Yes.
You know about this early voting that's taking place?
Yeah, I've heard about it.
I mean, 31 states, perhaps 24% of Americans have already voted. In some states, it's well over 50% of the number of people who voted in 2004. Listen to this and tell me what you think it means.
I was ready to walk away, and my older sister said, don't even think about it. You're going to stay here, and we're going to vote today.
I pretty much decided to early vote on a whim. I was walking on campus, and they stopped me and told me, did you know you could early vote today?
Extreme crowdedness. 1.5 to 2 hour wait.
I'd never really experienced people talking to me at the polls before or asking me questions or inquiring about how I was voting on, not just about the president, but other issues.
My county is a pretty Republican county. We will vote Republican, but it was really neat when I went to vote, the 12 or so people that were voting, it really was people from all walks of life, and it was a pretty good cross-section.
Those voices of early voters make a great point. Forget polls. We already have millions of Americans who have gone to the polls and give us an indication of what it's going to be like tomorrow. They're all participated in America's Exit Poll right here on The Takeaway.
Yeah, and I like hearing a Republican say the word neat.
Joining us now is Michael McDonald, Associate Professor of Government and Politics at George Mason University, to tell us what early voting means. And he's also a part of something called the United States Election Project. Dr. McDonald, thanks for being with us.
Oh, great to be with you.
First of all, where are you this morning?
I am at an undisclosed location next to Dick Cheney's cave where we run the exit polls.
Interesting. All right, what does early voting mean in terms of what to expect tomorrow?
Well, we've already had somewhere around 28 million people that we can document have already voted in this election. And the polls indicate that, and some of the information that we're getting from the states where we have demographic or partisan registration information about these voters is that they look to be overwhelmingly breaking towards Barack Obama. And that's a departure from previous elections. Usually Republicans do very well among early voters. ABC Washington Post poll in 2004 had Bush winning by about 60% to 40% in early voters. And this year they find an exact reversal of that, where Obama is winning 60% to 40%. We've seen very high volume of early voting in some states. We've already broken records in Georgia. We've already tripled the number of early voters from 2004. So we are seeing a tremendous amount of voting already taking place in some states that have more permissive early voting laws. And so as that vote piles up in some of these key battleground states, and it looks to be breaking favorably for Obama, if all those things are correct, then it's going to be very difficult for McCain to come from behind in some of these states in the last days of the election here.
Michael McDonald, let me just make a knee-jerk conclusion and deconstruct it for me. Okay, fine. So the Democrats are all voting early. The Republicans will vote on the day of, so it'll all balance out.
That's very possible. That's very possible that we're going to see, again, this reversal of a trend that we've seen over the last 20 years of early voting, which is that we may see the Republicans vote in higher numbers on Election Day versus the Democrats voting early. And there are some indications that there are indeed people who would have voted on Election Day anyway are the sorts of people who are energized to get out there now and vote for Obama. However, we also have some indications there are some people out there who are not high-propensity voters who are showing up at the polls. We've got new registrants. We've got some young people, and I think most notably, and this will be a trend to really watch on election night, is African Americans. If you look across the country where we do have these statistics, you're seeing African Americans turn out at elevated levels beyond anything that we've seen in recent American politics. So,
correct, Dr. McDonald, because there were like 600,000 African Americans who were registered to vote in 2004 who didn't go to vote. And now they're even like there's the estimation they're twice those numbers who are now registered to vote.
Yeah, well,
new voters.
Yeah, I don't have the registration statistics right at my fingertips, but we're seeing as a share of the early vote, African Americans in some of these southern states that have to track this sort of information for the Voting Rights Act. In some of these southern jurisdictions, we're seeing African Americans outpace their share of the 2004 entire electorate by about 8 percentage points in some of these southern
wow.
states. And that's just remarkable. And then you look at some of the urban counties that are out there where we don't have the race statistics, but we know that these are high African American population counties. Again, you're seeing this real uptick in early voting in these urban counties. And again, so you look across the country, you look at places like Franklin County and Cuyahoga County, two of the Democratic strongholds in Ohio, where the numbers look to be at over 20% now, perhaps, of the voters in those counties have already voted.
Wow.
And this actually could make a big difference on Election Day. I mean, not only does now the Obama campaign not have to go out and try and recruit these people to go vote on Tuesday, but also they're going to be shorter lines because they've processed more people already, and that could help because we traditionally in the last few elections had problems with long lines in some of these urban areas. We may not have that problem as much in states where we do have early voting in place.
Michael McDonald, a dumb question and a curious question, if you could answer them quickly, please. What do you think this bodes for the overall turnout for this election compared with other elections in the last century? And what do they do with early votes? Are they tabulated immediately, or are they counted on Election Day with all the rest of the votes?
Yeah, let me first answer the second question, which is by law, we have to count all these votes on Election Day.
Right.
And so you go back to 1845, we set a single day to hold elections in the United States, and the Supreme Court has ruled specifically on whether early voting is constitutional or abides by federal law. They said that and I love this word, it's such a great word, they say the election has to be consummated on Election Day. So even though people are voting now and they're casting those votes will not actually be opened up and looked at until Election Day. Now, the second part of the question, or the first part of the question, was about where this is placed in historical context. And
quickly,
we look at this election, we're going to beat the 60% turnout among those eligible in 2004, excuse me. And so you have to go back to the next highest turnout. I think that we may beat the 1960 turnout of 63.8%. And if so, we go all the way back to 1908 to find the next
wow.
highest turnout level, and that was 65.7%. So
100
we
years.
May really see 100 years.
100 years
politics.
Is a nice round number. Dr. Michael McDonald, Associate Professor of Government and Politics at George Mason University, and he runs the Election Project. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
So, Patrick, you got a slogan for this campaign?
I'm going to stick with the young and the restless.
Young and the restless. Very good. Thanks so much for being here.
Always.
Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor at Essence.
That's right.
Our takeaway contributor. You're going to be part of our election coverage.
Absolutely. Daniel Boone Bass.
That's right.
Up in Harlem.
Here's your takeaway.
If someone is drowning in the river and someone sticks out an arm to save you, you're not checking to see the color of that arm.
Takeaways political director Andrea Bernstein with a response to a question from Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell. What's your slogan for the campaign? Gabriel on our website writes, electile dysfunction. What's yours? 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.